I've been a primary author of two of the largest tax cuts in the history of our state.
Let the eagle soar.
Son, go outside and dust yourself off. And when you feel good again, come back in and talk to me. We know what they would have done because we know what they did.
K-Row. Come in there. K-Row.
We are going to fight for Missouri values. We are going to defend life. And we are going to protect our constitutional rights.
What I am trying to do to simply make tomorrow just a little bit better than today.
Hey there, this is Rachel Herndon Dunn, editor of the Missouri Times, back with another episode of the Hashtag MoLedge podcast. I'm here with my co-host Becky Lohman of the Catalyst Group and Ben Peters, who is celebrating his one-year anniversary here at the Missouri Times. He is wearing a top hat. He has confetti just circling him as he walks the Capitol halls today.
We brought the cake. We have a cake.
Yes, we're going to bust out the cake in the last segment. Super excited. But first off, I want to thank so much to our Hashtag MoLedge podcast sponsor, the St. Louis Regional Chamber of Commerce, because today we welcome Mark Ellinger, of Bliss, Barger, and Deutsch for another episode of The Autumn of the Attorney. So Mark, you've been in politics for a while. You've served in office here in Cole County, right? You've done a lot of legal work on campaign finance, and word on the street is you worked for former auditor Margaret Kelly around the turn of the century when former governor... It's weird to say that, isn't it? Turn of the century.
Turn of the century. I feel so old now.
Yeah, that's what you're making me feel old.
Back in the roaring 90s, I remember how great it was.
When former governor Mel Carnahan was in office, and I know you remember his service and you remember his death very clearly. And it's the anniversary of his death this week, and there's been a lot of people talking about it, and it's interesting to compare politics. And so I've had some readers remark to me that politics has changed a lot since Governor Carnahan. What do you think?
I think politics substantively have not changed a lot since Governor Carnahan. In fact, I think today's politics, the way we live them and experience them, mostly in Missouri, much different maybe than in D.C., I think Mel Carnahan was really kind of the guy who created this political structure in the state. For folks, you know, I worked with Margaret Kelly. I was her legal counsel. All that time when I was working for her as state auditor, she was the only Republican statewide elected official.
Interesting. The exact opposite of today.
Exact opposite of today. Then that's that off-year election thing, mm-hmm, which is right. Why the auditor is the off-year election. It's an interesting... unique twist of the Missouri Constitution. Mel Carnahan was governor during that entire period of time also. So, in fact, in 1996, Margaret Kelly ran against Mel Carnahan in the gubernatorial race, and Mel won re-election that year. But from being on the other side of the aisle and working legislative work for the auditor, doing political work outside of the office. On my volunteer time, we were all really careful about that. The auditor was a CPA, and she really wanted to make sure that the ethics were absolutely inscrutable, which after 1992, most people who are old enough to remember understand why ethics were really inscrutable. You know, Mel Carnahan was a brutal politician, and the people that he surrounded himself with, very talented, were equally brutal. The whole concept that everybody was collegial and got along and, you know, it was a better day and a better time, that's all bunk. Anybody who worked against Mel Carnahan, any Republican who worked against Mel Carnahan back then, anybody on an issue that worked against Mel Carnahan knew that they were brutal. No holds barred. Fought everything with every fiber of their being, as nasty as they could. They marshaled state resources in political campaigns, which was candidly had always been done that way. They were really good at it. There was a constitutional amendment during Carnahan's campaign called Hancock II, which was after the largest tax increase in Missouri history was passed by the Democrats in the General Assembly and signed by the governor. There was a grassroots effort to ratchet that down and fix it. The Department of Natural Resources was, for example, enlisted to actively campaign against that constitutional amendment. Now, can you imagine that today? A state government agency actually campaigning against a ballot measure? If anything, on certain level, politics better now today than it was before. It's certainly more transparent.
It's interesting you say that, because I kind of think social media is ruining politics. And I, especially yesterday, there were all these glory day photos of Governor Carnahan. And they're black and white, which is kind of funny because it was the 90s. We had color.
Everything was in
color.
It was
the turn of the century, though. Right?
It wasn't It wasn't even Technicolor. It was real color.
Yeah. And so it just looks like these glory days. And now we have also full color web ads on every single bill, every single political movement. It's all over Facebook. It's all over Twitter. And I guess you could say that's a new brutal politic to have. Now,
I'm not sure that's new. I think the media is new. Social media is
literally.
New. You know, when you go back to when Carnahan was governor in the 90s, you had radio, you had TV, and you had print. And that was it. There was nothing else. So, you know, you had a more constrained environment in how information got out. That didn't mean if you listened to talk radio, you didn't constantly hear people in the state talking about every bill, every issue that was going on. You just weren't able to beam it out on, you know, a little handheld device. Ironically, just to let people out there, your younger listeners know, in the 90s, we did have cell phones.
Like the huge brick cell phones, right?
Yeah.
They had them, but they were not.
They were attached
owned
to a bag,
a
and you had to put them under the seat so no one stole them.
So if you have.
Did people use them in the Capitol?
Yes, they did. The reption was god awful.
There
were no boosters inside the Capitol. I will say that if you had, and I noticed looking around the table here, just for your listeners out there, I see different types of cell phones. One of you has a really large cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. The big. That cell phone is actually, and that's what, a 7 Plus?
7 Plus, yeah.
So this iPhone 7, the iPhone 7 Plus is actually bigger than the cell phone I used when I was in, working in the Capitol in 97, because I remember taking a phone call on a Supreme Court case I was doing and pulling it out of a jacket pocket. It was thicker, but it was much smaller.
Interesting.
So...
And well, now this is the high demand is the plus, right? You used to want it small, and now it's funny how it goes the other way.
There's actually been a few politicos that I know here in Missouri politics who have the iPhone 8 Plus that just came out, and word is don't get it because your battery will expand and your phone will literally break in two.
Yeah.
Hmm. Okay.
So we are here.
I'll avoid that.
Yeah.
We have special guests today, in case you just tuned in with us, because we actually picked up some radio stations, and people apparently want to listen to us beyond our inner
I've
circle.
I've known that all along. That's been my mindset for forever. Everybody loves listening to what I have to say.
we're here with Mark
Ellinger.
Ellinger. It's funny, I went to high school with someone who had the same spelling of his last name, and it was Ellinger. So I even spelled it out phonetically, still botched it. he is a name that I see as a reporter, and Ben sees as a reporter, and Michael is starting to see as a reporter a lot on MEC paperwork. And we were just talking about the anniversary of the death of Mel Carnahan, and something we talked about before we started taping was the night that the governor... died in the plane accident. He was on the way to a fundraiser.
That's right.
And
that's
it was
right.
A small dollar fundraiser. The governor had less than $125,000 in the bank.
If memory serves, it was about $160,000 in the bank.
Wow.
And that was in a U.S. Senate race, what, 2.5-3 weeks before the election. And John Ashcroft, who he was running against, had about $2.4 million in the bank at the same time. It was the reason he was flying to the boot heel, was to raise money. They had to keep the lights on.
Interesting. And so back then, you know, at the turn of the century, as we were talking about, there wasn't as much PAC involvement, so you didn't have multiple $100,000 checks or money spent on behalf of you in the millions then what are some other, and this was a federal race, to be clear, and of course campaign finance on the state side was also different, and it has evolved since. Something I kind of want to get your view on is Amendment 2. It's, even as a non-attorney such as myself, it was written kind of sloppy. And every day, it seems like once a week, Becky, over in her lobbying world, is like, hey, is this allowed? And I'm just like, I don't know.
So, Amendment 2 is the best way I can say it. The nicest way I can say it is a piece of junk. And that's not a political commentary. That's almost more of a legal commentary. So, Senate Bill 844 was passed by the General Assembly a bunch of years ago. And it was campaign finance reform. They tried to reinstitute it after a process of eliminating campaign finance reform in the state, or eliminating campaign contribution limits, excuse me. Senate Bill 844 was passed. It was thrown out by the Supreme Court over a technicality. The keys to the Whispering Gallery were in that bill. If you know the story about the keys to the Whispering Gallery, that was part of that bill, Senate Bill 844. There are all sorts of things that got thrown into the bill. The Supreme Court ultimately threw it out over multiple subjects. But it's interesting, the trial court in that case, the Cole County Circuit Court, also as a secondary decision, found that Senate Bill 844 was unconstitutional on its merits. The campaign finance side of it was unconstitutional. I thought that was interesting because obviously Amendment 2 is really Senate Bill 844 with an constitutional amendment slapped on the top of it. It's the laziest piece of legal work I've ever seen because they didn't actually write it.
There was copying and pasting, right?
It's exactly copying and pasting.
So it refers to different committees struck, you know, the language, the verbiage doesn't match up to today.
Exactly.
And as a result, you end up with this constitutional amendment because if you put campaign finance reform on the ballot, everybody will vote for it all the time because everybody wants something different. Nobody can tell you what they want, but everybody doesn't want what we have today. And it passed overwhelmingly.
Right.
But it's junk. Anybody who has to live under it, you know, it's great for lawyers. Let me start off by saying, you know, as an equal opportunity lawyer, I'm happy to represent people that because you need a lawyer to understand it. It's not written cleanly. It's, you know, it was sold as we're going to put in campaign finance contribution limits.
Right.
Well, that's what, five sentences? But it's 15 pages long.
Did it need to be a constitutional amendment?
Probably would have been best to have been a constitutional amendment. To do campaign finance limits, you enshrine it in the Constitution. I'm against them. I don't like campaign finance limits. I think they're wrong. I think they push money into the dark areas as opposed to pushing them out in the light. That being said, if I was going to put campaign finance limits into law in Missouri, I would put them in the Constitution. I'd put them in real simply.
So to fix, if we were to fix this, we would have to do another constitutional amendment, wouldn't we?
We would. And effectively, the campaign finance limits themselves are really pretty easy to understand if you read
right.
it. It's all the other stuff. It's all the limitations on who can contribute to what, when you can contribute, how much you can contribute, can PACs contribute to candidates, can PACs contribute to PACs, can corporations contribute to PACs. So we all go to court, and we get to find out, and we get the answers in little bits and pieces.
And the lawyers know it, but, I mean, the lobbyists and legislators working in the building, if they don't know the rules, certainly the general public doesn't know the rules, and the rules are so confusing. Not only can you not understand them, you don't even know what the point of them is to begin with,
right?
So I always think, if I'm confused, if I don't know what money's, what PACs are what, then certainly, you know, regular voters don't know that either.
Well, and think about a regular state rep race, not a big high profile one that everybody's playing in, but a small local state rep race. You know, you have relatively unsophisticated folks running those campaigns because it's not contested. You don't need HRCC, you don't need, you know, a big campaign advisory team. And you're doing what you've always done. You go out and raise money.
Right.
You know, you have a chicken dinner, you know, all the things you do. Or your school bond issue. This is a real example. School ballot issue. And you go out and you raise money. And where's the first place every school ballot issue goes to? They go to their Chamber of Commerce. And they say, hey, write us a check to support us. As long as time can remember, Chambers of Commerce support ballot issues. Chambers of Commerce are corporations. Corporations can't contribute to campaigns.
Right.
So every school ballot issue suddenly has changed. You can't go to the local bank, the local feed store, and say, hey, write us a check. Now you got to go to the owner of the local feed store and say, hey, I know you've always written a check. Your company can't write a check anymore. It has to be you personally.
Right.
And when you think of small businesses in small communities, right, the owners of these businesses are multimillionaires, right? They're just trying to make a living, and now you're, you know, digging into their personal pockets, and businesses in your local community can't support you.
Yeah.
You show up with your $10 a ticket chicken dinner tickets, and you go to the local convenience store owned by a corporation. Local corporation, you say, hey, can we put these on the counter and would you sell them for us? Time immemorial, that's okay. Now that's probably it's an in-kind contribution because you're selling the tickets from a corporation to the local candidate's campaign. That's a violation. You've just committed a crime in Missouri, theoretically. Because the Constitution now creates criminal offenses, too.
That's a bit much.
But at the risk of offending everybody on here, 74% of you voted for that.
I don't know that listeners voted for it. I wonder what the percentage of listeners that voted for
it.
Probably a lot less than the general public.
But, you know, I mean, and I'll call people out because I don't have any bias. I don't have any reason not to. But the, you know, one of the highest ranking people inside the Attorney General's office was the attorney for that ballot measure, John Sauer, who is, I don't know if he's the Deputy Attorney General, I think he's the Solicitor General of the state, I don't know what title, they have all sorts of interesting titles over there, but he was the guy who supported that. I mean, I litigated parts of it against him. He defended it before it went on the ballot as an important piece of law that would clarify and simplify our campaign finance and create more transparency. It's junk.
So something I want to talk about that's kind of developed since Amendment 2 became real, and we've talked about this on a few past podcasts, is that the PAC climate has been very interesting. Like Holly Rader, Rep. Holly Rader was kind of the first that had Holly PAC, and now we've got like state reps who have their own PAC, and it kind of gets around a lot of...
And it's for the reasons we just discussed. These local state reps, they don't have options. They don't have options. Like, and in 2017, a campaign is going to cost what it's going to cost.
Exactly.
Right?
And whenever you go from being used to being able to raise as much money as you possibly want, being able to take as much money as you want, to being only take $2,600 per person.
And how much are these? You know, how much are some of these local reps in small towns raising anyway? You know, they're not bringing in...
But let's differentiate, I think. It's not the dollar amount that's the impact. I mean, you'd look at most state reps in non-highly contested districts. You know, throw out the southern Boone County seat that's always, you know, a 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, keep adding numbers, $1,000 race over one state rep seat. It's crazy. But you look at most state rep seats, very few people get those large contributions. They don't need them. Mm-hmm. They're not out... It becomes the story in the local community if somebody gets a big contribution.
Right.
So they're way better getting $300, $400, $500 from the local businesses because that says something. Can't do that anymore. That's the stuff that just doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive. And you're right. When you talk about these PACs being created, it's because you can't take money from a corporation. It's because you can't take money from anybody else. It's not so much to get the $10,000. Now, you know, certain state reps need that kind of cash infusion, and certain state reps and other candidates are looking to run to bigger and higher office where the dollars just inflate. But you have to have it just to take contributions from certain entities. Now, it's really a very poorly constructed system, and it's going to make, my opinion, it's going to make our system more opaque. It's going to make our system harder for the average person to be involved in, and it's going to create problems. And if the Ethics Commission wanted to do something and really strictly enforce it, half the people in the state of Missouri are going to find themselves that contribute are going to find themselves up on some type of election complaint.
And the question is, I think, from my perspective, there was a specific reason these rules were written, right, to prevent some very wealthy people from influencing elections. So the question is, was that achieved? I don't think so. I don't think that people that want to invest in politics have stopped doing that at all. They just figured a workaround that makes it harder for voters to figure out what's going on.
And you know, I'll go all the way back to the beginning and talk about how did things change from a campaign finance perspective from when Mel Carnahan was governor until now. The biggest single change is the C4 climate. We C4s and just more limited extent PACs really didn't play in political campaigns back then. There was a need to. You know, on a statewide race, whether it was inside the state, i.e. under the state campaign finance laws, or even if it was a state Senate race under the federal laws, you know, you had your Missouri Republican Party, your Missouri Democrat Party, you had your, you know, House Republican Campaign Committee, and you had the same national types of entities, RGA, all those still existed back then, and they all played to a certain extent in the game. But in the end, it was mostly I can't remember what the campaign contribution limit number was now, but you know, it was $2,000 contributions from as many people as you could get. And a governor's race was a $6-8 million race. People go, wow, that's a lot of money that was spent. I mean, we see $6-8 million contributions nowadays.
So I think it's interesting. Back whenever I first got in politics, I was basically told, like, you can get elected to the state house for $30,000 if you spend it right. And I mean, even with campaign finance, that's 10, 15 checks for $2,600.
That's right.
And I mean, there's really no reason a good politician couldn't get that in, honestly, a day.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to dial for dollars and you're going to go outside your district to raise money, that's easy.
Right.
Most local politicians, and, you know, I was a low county commissioner. I was outspent 3-1 by my opponent. But I raised more money in Cole County than contributions from outside the county. You had a lot of labor connections, and they were funneling a lot of money in.
Whenever at campaign schools, is get money from your district because some people will be personally invested. They'll tell their friends. They'll
raise money. You know, first of all, everybody hates asking for money. It's, you know, nobody local area, and it's particularly hard in local races where there's the R and the D. Easy to raise money if you're unopposed. If you're a Democrat in a Democrat area, it's easy to raise money. Democrat to raise money in Cole County.
That's because very accurate.
Everybody who writes that personal check votes 70% Republican.
It's the new scarlet letter.
Yeah, and it's vice versa. I mean, you know, they're not going to do it.
So I have one last question here with Mark Ellinger, and he is a longtime turn of the city that we made fun of me for. But something that's been a big conversation this last year has been dark money, that it might create some problems. What kind of problems are we talking about, like, from your view as an attorney?
Well, so when you get into money coming through multiple venues, multiple entities, you lose the transparency of seeing who is funding campaigns. And there is an advantage to seeing who has funded campaigns. Not so much for a $100 contribution or a $500 contribution, but a $1 million contribution, you know, maybe that's something you do want to know who's financing that. You know, there are all sorts of freedom of speech issues you can raise, freedom of assembly. I mean, can you imagine if to print papers in 1775 you had to identify who was donating the money, we would not have had any papers against the British government. You know, I mean, there are reasons we want some anonymity and we want some ability of free political speech. There's a line to be drawn there. The more we ratchet down on one end of the line with, you know, an Amendment 2 is a classic example of it. The more you ratchet down on Amendment 2, you put in campaign finance contributions, you put in strict limitations on who can donate, all you do is invariably push the money in a different direction. And the only direction to push it into is into areas that don't require disclosure, because there's no other option.
Right.
And when you get into areas that don't require disclosure, you know, I think most people that are contributing to C4s don't make bones about it. They're active politically, and people know who they are. And most of them, the vast majority, are not looking for any kind of personal benefit at all. But the danger's there because it's secret. And that's the reason you want transparency. I'm when I was working on the House Republican Campaign Committee, I spent a lot of time over at the old Missouri Republican Party headquarters. And I remember the executive director of the party saying, I don't want campaign finance limits at all. I just want instant transparency. I just want to know who's giving the money. Give as much as you want. Yeah. $1 million public contribution, in my mind, is totally fine. As long as you see who it's from. The new, I mean, that's your job to write the article about the person who makes the big contribution.
And then voters get to determine if it's if they like if it or they don't, right?
Yeah.
And isn't
at least
that
we
how
hold them accountable.
Isn't that how the system's supposed to work? I mean, the media is supposed to do its job, and its job, although it's changed a lot, its job is really reporting. It's get the facts out. Don't spin it. Put the facts out. Let people make their own decisions. If you have a transparent system and the media puts the facts out, you know, Becky, you're right. The voters get to decide because they're informed. How do you get informed when it's all in the back channels?
You don't. I think it's funny you say don't spin it, because Michael just joined us a few weeks ago, and I keep telling him, I'm like, get the facts out, and then you can write a feature about it. But report, and then you can spin.
We need more people that have that opinion in the media.
So we asked you three questions this summer, whenever we featured you on the 50 Political Pros You Need to Know in the Missouri Times Magazine. It was a joy to include you there. And we have five questions for you now from Becky.
Hopefully they're a little better. I don't know.
I think they're better.
Question one. What are you personally interested in that most people haven't heard of or don't know anything about?
About me personally?
Yeah.
Well,
these are personal questions. They're not political questions.
Some people know this pretty well. I'm kind of a wine connoisseur. It's my little habit that I've developed over the years. Not to mention I like to drink it too periodically.
I was going
to
say air quotes are a habit.
Yeah. But no, I like to. When I travel, I like to go to places that are in wine country, and I built a cellar in my house, and I'm very proud of that. And I work really hard at it. It's kind of. You'd think as a lawyer, the last thing you'd ever want to do is read, but I'm constantly reading wine publications to learn about new things that are going on, so.
It's kind of funny. The other morning, my husband came and woke me up. Like, I'm just not a morning person, but he came and woke me up. He's like, Rachel, Sonoma's burning. They're going to raise prices on your wine. And so I text Becky. I'm like, Becky, Sonoma's burning. I need to go get wine.
Well, I was in Napa Valley on the Sunday and Monday a week before the fire.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. And I can show you pictures of one of the wineries. We have a friend who owns a winery there, and we were with them at the top of the hill, and how dry everything was. And my wife actually mentioned to me, you know, it's so dry up here. If a spark got going, this whole place would go up.
Because they had a ton of rain last season, right? And that's why. So they had all the foliage and greenery that then dried up. And
so I think it's I don't know if you know Zach Bruner. He works over at Plotron and Macintosh. One of his clients is Adam Pupta. And he has this great story about how there was apparently a drought in France or something. They sent over their grapes to Missouri, and we, like, preserved their vines. Anyway, it's a better story coming from him.
I can tell you the Floxera story. Every grape Bordeaux that you've ever had is actually Missouri wine.
Interesting.
And that's because the Bordeaux wines were hit by a disease called Floxera. Don't try to spell it.
Okay.
It's got too many PHs and Ys and stuff in it. But it was hit by a disease called Floxera, and it was wiping out the Bordeaux vineyards. Missouri grape stock is naturally resistant to it. So they grafted Missouri grape stock onto all the great Bordeaux wines to save the vintages. It doesn't change the wine, but it imparts the immunity. This was, I think, in the late 1800s.
The other turn of the century?
Yeah, the other turn. The roaring 90s, or whatever they're called. You know. And it's interesting. Now I see, this is why you ask a personal question with this long story, but it's interesting because, you know, that's genetic engineering. Today, people would go, oh my God, that's a genetically modified organism.
We need to label all the Bordeaux.
That's how they save the great wines. Missouri wine, right there.
Missouri wine, there you go.
Second question.
Question two. What is something you think everyone should do at least once in their lives?
Travel to Europe, travel overseas, get out of the United States and see the rest of the world.
Interesting. Interesting.
Does Mexico count for our listeners?
No.
Mexico and Andre County?
Right.
And going to Versailles, it does not count.
You know, California, Missouri, I always find that.
Moscow Mills. Yeah, get out of the United States. Get over the ocean. Get away from Canada and Mexico, which are just too close. They have too much of the American culture. Get overseas and see what the rest of the world's like. Not only will you enjoy it, but you will certainly come to a new appreciation for many of the great things in this country.
So fun. When I lived in St. Louis and I was moving to Columbia, Missouri, everybody thought I was moving to Columbia, the country, and thought I had a lot of cool street cred, and then immediately it tanked when I was like, no, just middle, just, Boone
just
County.
Over
there. I was checking into an airport in Rome, and I said, my bag is going to Columbia.
Yeah.
And the lady at the counter goes, okay, Bogota.
Yeah. No.
C-O-U. The airport
Columbia,
is C-O-U.
Not Columbia. There's no cool phonetics in there. Question three, maybe you just answered this with the first question. What is your favorite drink?
My favorite drink is Bordeaux wine.
Okay.
And it's a rare pleasure, and anybody who's not had
it. Is that what's in your coffee cup this morning?
No, this is probably the second thing I drink. I will say this is rocket fuel from Coffee Zone.
I think every politico lives on half rocket fuel and then half their wine. Their wine or
and all I can tell you, I drink a lot more of this in a day than a wine, and my life would probably be a lot less stressful if I was doing it the other way around, right?
Very, very true. Question four. What is something that is considered to be a luxury that you personally couldn't go a day without?
Oh my gosh. What's a luxury I couldn't go a day without? Coffee.
Yeah.
I've gone extended periods without wine. There's no other food that really, not a close. It's got to be coffee. I have to have coffee every day.
Good coffee? Are you kind of a coffee snob? Because I'm a bit of a coffee snob.
Yeah.
It's got to be strong. And it's got to be tasty. I can't stand Starbucks. Sorry, all you Starbucks people out there. It tastes burnt to me. I don't like the burnt taste.
As an aside, for those of you who will be coming back to Jefferson City in January, by the time you come back, Dunkin' Donuts will be open, I believe. And I'm very excited for that because I actually buy Dunkin' Donuts coffee by the bag from Sam's Club. And it'll be nice to have a drive-through coffee place.
So we were talking about Coffee Zone. It is the place to go in Jeff City for everybody in politics. I'm a regular there, to say it mildly, to the point that they have a salad named after me that I eat almost every day. That's when you know my wife and I both have a seat there frequently. She works a block and a half away from me. She's the head of human resources for Central Bank Company, the whole bank's company system. And she and I go eat lunch anytime we can. And she has a salad name for her. I have a salad name for me.
Is it the Mark or the Ellinger?
It's the Mark. Okay. And my wife's name is Chrissy. It's the Mark and the Chrissy. If you like gyro meat and grilled onions on a spinach salad, that's a Mark. And if you like a chicken breast on a spinach salad with light dressing, that's a Chrissy.
Now all our listeners have something to aspire to, right? Like, you think you're a good lobbyist. You think you're a good politician. Like,
do you have a salad?
Right. If you don't have a meal named after you by a local restaurant in Jeff City, then keep trying. No. Keep working.
Or a drink.
Can I just have like a regular glass of wine, like a Sauvignon Blanc glass of wine named after me? Yeah. Is that how that works?
I think we can make that happen.
I think Grand would do that for me.
So if you don't follow Yanni, who owns Coffee Zone, on Instagram, you should, because the first lady actually goes to Coffee Zone, I think, every morning. And he posted a picture of him with the governor and the first lady. The governor was wearing a great pullover. I will probably endorse the governor's Royals pullover. It's good stuff. Sorry.
I always say the people that work in the local businesses probably have such good political intel, it's insane. Like, you need to be like, okay, this is the amendment I'm on the lookout for. Like, when this person rolls in hot, I need you to listen and then
press the red button.
Text me the details, exactly.
So all I can say about the first lady is, as I walked out on my way over here this morning, she was walking in.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's interesting.
There you go. Last question. And I think this one's the most fun. What is the most annoying question people ask you? Professionally or personally?
Because we were thinking as an attorney, like, you've got to have people be like, hey, Mark.
The worst question, the worst question, and it absolutely drives me crazy, is, do you know who I am?
What?
Or do you remember me? People, like, I was... people in high school, you know, from high school, they come up to you and it's, you know, I graduated high school in 1985. What is that? You know, 32 years ago. And somebody will come up and say, do you remember me?
Well, you do have a salad named after yourself. Well, yeah, big, you know,
I don't mean it in any disrespect to anybody, but that's putting people on the spot. It's kind of a really rude and unfair thing to say to somebody.
I genuinely didn't know if he was going to go with, like, the high school horrors or if he was going to go, like, he has a stalker.
You know,
like, do you remember
me? It is October. I've been watching all the scary movies.
So you, if anybody out there who's ever had somebody walk up to him who, if you knew who they were, you'd say, hey, Rachel, how are you doing? It's great to see you. When you walk up to somebody and they say hi to you and you just say hi back, you probably ought to know. Okay, I'm not sure. You know, do you remember me? Do you know who I am?
Hashtag reasons I only go to Lisa for 10 minutes at a time.
Right.
You know, I actually, you know, the irony of it is I was at the Georgia game. My oldest son plays football for Mizzou.
Oh, cool.
So we were in Athens this weekend. And before the game, a guy comes down, taps me on the shoulder, looks at me and says, do you remember me?
So this has recently grinded your gears. That's why.
And the good thing was, it was somebody I knew. And ooh, I didn't know him right off the bat. So it wasn't a problem. But that happens far too often.
The answer is yes, it's still awkward. To be like, yeah, I do. Like, yeah. It's just, yeah, it's an uncomfortable exchange.
There's segues to make that more graceful.
You asked the question. I just
I love the honest answer. So, that was that's, our five, that's our five questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mark Ellinger.
Ellinger.
Ellinger? No.
It's only been 28 minutes today.
It has. Anyway, and of course, thank you to our sponsors, the St. Louis Regional Chamber of Commerce, for supporting the Autumn of the Attorney, and thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon.